to meet Leopold, and the king charmed Lapsley as much as he did other visitors. In May 1890, Shepherd and Lapsley arrived in the Congo, and for some weeks stayed at a mission station just outside Matadi. As the two of them assembled porters and supplies for the trip around the lower Congo River rapids, someone else doing the same thing on the streets of this small hillside town was Joseph Conrad. He and his caravan began walking up the trail to Stanley Pool 11 days after the Americans. Having conferred with experienced missionaries at Stanley Pool and upriver, Lapsley and Shepherd decided to establish the first Southern Presbyterian mission far up the Kasai River. Shepherd went off into the bush for several weeks to recruit African helpers. Lapsley stayed at an American mission station in Leopoldville, where he again crossed paths with Conrad. The novelist may have braved not just malaria and dysentery, but also some evangelizing. Conrad, Lapsley wrote home, is sick in a room at the other end of the court. As I sit, I look across the fruit and palm trees right into his window. He is a gentlemanly fellow. An English testament on his table furnishes a handle I hope to use on him. Once they completed their preparations, the two young missionaries headed up the Kasai. The letters Lapsley sent home during these months ring with an admiration for Shepherd that would have been nearly impossible for a white man to voice for a black back home. The Bateke think there is nobody like Mundele Ndom, the black-white man, as they call Shepherd. His temper is bright and even, really a man of unusual graces and strong points of character. So I am thankful to God for Shepherd. He describes Shepherd as a born trader. I let him do most of the buying, and speaks admiringly of Shepherd's physical hardiness and his skill at hunting, of his coping with storms that threatened to blow away their tents, and of Shepherd's pulling himself 15 feet down an anchor chain underwater to loosen the snagged anchor. Shepherd once shot a hippo, jumped into the water to tie a rope around it, and narrowly escaped a crocodile, who also had an eye on the hippo. The black man was supposed to be the junior partner in the mission, but as one reads Lapsley's letters, one is reminded of James Barry's play The Admirable Crichton, in which a yacht full of upper-class Britons is shipwrecked on an island, and the resourceful butler becomes the leader. William Shepherd was the first black American missionary in the Congo. As we listen to him in the book, letters, and magazine articles he writes over the next 2 decades, and in speeches given to rapt audiences at Hampton and elsewhere while he is on leave, we hear someone strikingly different from almost all the Americans and Europeans who have been to Africa before him. He is, to be sure, a Christian evangelist, and remains one for the 20 years he works in Africa. He occasionally expresses the customary condescension toward the dense darkness of heathenism and the wild, naked savages bowing down to idols filled with superstition and sin. But his tone is usually far different. "I always wanted to live in Africa," Shepherd writes to a friend back in the United States. "I felt that I would be happy, and so I am." He eagerly absorbs his new surroundings along the Kasai River. "We immediately began to study their language by pointing at objects and writing down the names they gave us. He acquires pet parrots and a small black monkey, jokingly named Tipu Tip, after the Afro-Arab slave trader. His voice, stronger and more confident, becomes that of a man who feels, in a way that is perhaps politically and religiously too risky for him to fully explore, that he has come home. He rejoices at being among my people in the country of my forefathers." In early 1892, Lapsley had to go to Boma, the capital, on mission business, and left Shepherd alone for some months on the Kasai. When Shepherd joyfully met the steamer he thought was bringing Lapsley back, to his shock he found a letter from another missionary. "Dear Brother Shepherd, you will be surprised and grieved to know that your friend and comrade, the Reverend S. N. Lapsley, while here at the coast, was taken down with bilious hematuric fever, and on the 26th of March died." The Southern Presbyterians, embarrassed to find themselves with a black man in de facto command of their new Congo mission, dispatched more white Presbyterians to the Congo. By the time they arrived, Shepherd had had several years' experience in the territory and had become, according to a Belgian trader, very popular among the Bakuba, whose language he alone speaks of all the Europeans. Shepherd continued to thrive. He loved to hunt and was famous for his charismatic oratory and strength. He rode what he cheerfully claimed was the first bicycle in Central Africa. His joie de vivre seems to have made him liked by almost everyone, black and white. It may be a measure of his popularity that when, later in his life, he strayed from his marriage and fathered a son with a village woman, the transgression did not end his career in the church. The boy, called Chapit, as the Africans called his father, eventually ended up running the mission printing press. Unlike other missionaries, generally a pretty somber-looking lot, in photographs Shepherd seems to be enjoying himself, whether posing with game he has shot or jubilantly displaying a giant dead snake or strumming a banjo. Tall and husky, he stands among a group of black warriors with spears and shields, holding a spear himself. Or, with a rifle, he grins broadly, a row of men with bows and arrows arrayed beside him. Again and again, Shepherd strikes a distinctive pose. He is wearing a white sun helmet, white shirt, white tie, white linen suit, even white canvas shoes. His chest is thrust out, his hands confidently on his hips, and, amid a group of Africans, his smile is warm and proud, and almost proprietary. He has the distinct look of a football coach showing off a winning team. The area where Shepherd was working bordered on the homeland of the Kuba people. The Kuba are among Africans' greatest artists, working in masks, sculpture, textiles, and elaborately carved tools. Shepherd's collection of Kuba art, much of which ended up at his alma mater in Virginia, was the first significant one acquired by an outsider. He made ethnographic notes on the Kuba and other peoples of the Kasai region, and recorded ancestral myths, rituals, and crop yields. Although he is frank to say when some practice, such as human sacrifice or the killing of women as witches, appalls him, his writings show an empathetic, respectful curiosity about African customs radically different from the harsh, quick judgments of someone like Stanley. Shepherd was particularly impressed with the Kuba who make one feel that he has again entered a land of civilization. Perhaps they got their civilization from the Egyptians, or the Egyptians got theirs from the Bakuba. Shepherd was fascinated when he saw a Kuba ceremonial cup for drinking palm wine. Carved on it was a face with features strikingly similar to those on ancient Egyptian artifacts. "The cup is made of mahogany," Shepherd wrote, "and the face on it seems to verify their tradition that many, many years ago they came from a faraway land." Because of its location deep in the Congo's interior, the Kuba kingdom had been largely protected from the slave raiders of both the east and west coasts. The Kuba valued their isolation and did all they could to keep outsiders at bay. Their homeland was within the boundaries of the territory Europe had recognized as Leopold's, but at this early stage of colony building, his sovereignty over more remote areas existed only on paper. For nearly a decade, Belgian traders had been trying to gain access to the Kuba kingdom and had been repeatedly turned away. Gifts they sent to its king were returned. Achieving something most anthropologists can only dream of, in 1892, Shepherd became the first foreigner to reach the town of Ifuka, seat of the court of the Kuba king, Kot Ambikwe II. The king had repeatedly threatened to behead anyone who helped strangers intrude, so no one dared give Shepherd directions. It took him and a small group of Africans 3 months to find their way to the capital, which they finally did by clandestinely following the trail of an ivory caravan. Shepherd was still dressed all in white, including white canvas shoes and, what had been, he writes ruefully, his white linen suit. The king angrily ordered Shepherd, his followers, and everyone who had helped them brought to court for beheading. Then he discovered that the intruder had dark skin and could speak some Kuba. This meant, the elders decided, that he was a reincarnated spirit. Furthermore, they announced that they knew just who he was, Bope Makabe, a former king. According to Shepherd, nothing he could say about his greater king in heaven would convince them otherwise. The noted anthropologist Jan Vansina has a different interpretation. Since the name Bope Makabe is not in the Kuba royal genealogy, he suggests that the Kuba may have understood who Shepherd was and were simply trying to flatter him into revealing the plans of other Europeans who wanted to enter the kingdom. This visit was one of the high points of Shepherd's life, and provided a mine of information for later scholars, for the Kuba had one of Central Africa's most sophisticated political systems. Shepherd remained at the Kuba court for 4 months, and, interested in all he saw, made notes about everything from court rituals to the workings of a royal police force that dealt with thefts and other crimes. Servants spread leopard skins for him to walk on whenever he approached the king, who sat on an ivory throne and wore a crown of beads and feathers. "I grew very fond of the Bakuba," he writes. "They were the finest-looking race I had seen in Africa, dignified, graceful, courageous, honest, with an open, smiling countenance, and really hospitable. Their knowledge of weaving, embroidery, wood-carving, and smelting was the highest in equatorial Africa." Shepherd attended an annual gathering of chiefs and headmen from the towns of the kingdom, where each in turn reported on births, deaths, harvests, and other events in his domain, and did a ceremonial dance. The book he later wrote about his experiences in Africa is entitled Presbyterian Pioneers in Congo, but the distinctly un-Presbyterian Kuba run away with the story. His is a valuable first-hand look at one of the last great African kingdoms unchanged by European influence. The Kuba creation myth, Shepherd reports, says that their first people, man and woman, were let down from the skies by a rope, from which they untied themselves, and the rope was drawn up. Soon after this first visit to the Kuba, Shepherd headed back to the United States on leave. On the way, he was invited to lecture at Exeter Hall in London. For his travels in the Kuba Kingdom and his discovery of a lake Europeans had not known about, he was made a Fellow of the Royal Geographical Society, the only Presbyterian missionary so honored. The Society also named his discovery Lake Shepherd. In Washington, Shepherd presented President Grover Cleveland with a Kuba bamboo mat. On a later visit, he gave Theodore Roosevelt a pipe and a palm fiber coverlet. On these trips home, Shepherd delivered innumerable speeches at colleges, universities, and churches throughout the country, and his fervent preaching about Africa recruited more black missionaries for the Presbyterians. One of them, Lucy Gant, a teacher and talented singer whom he had known while still a theology student, he married. To help staff what eventually became several mission stations, more white Presbyterians came to Africa as well, and a white man was always in charge. On the official rolls of the Southern Presbyterian Mission Society, published in the United States, Shepherd and his new recruits always had colored or C after their names. But in Africa itself, he did not feel relegated to second-class citizenship. He called one of his children Maxamalenge, after a son of the Kuba king. Not surprisingly, the Kuba were happy with their existing way of life, and, despite their friendliness toward Shepherd, showed little interest in Christianity. The mission station Shepherd ran among them made few converts. But Shepherd had become so well known back home for his discoveries that the Presbyterians were afraid of an adverse public reaction if they closed his mission to the Kuba and stationed him elsewhere. The entire Kasai region, like the rest of the Congo, in time succumbed to the tightening grip of the Congo state. Some 8 years after Shepherd's historic visit, Leopold's forces finally reached and looted the Kuba capital. The raid on the capital, like many other events in the Congo, was triggered by a discovery far away. One day, a few years before William Shepherd first embarked for Africa, a veterinary surgeon with a majestic white beard was tinkering with his son's tricycle at his home in Belfast, Ireland. John Dunlop was trying to solve a problem that had bedeviled bicyclists for many years. How do you get a gentle ride without springs? Dunlop finally devised a practical way of making a long-sought solution, an inflatable rubber tire. In 1890, the Dunlop Company began making tires, setting off a bicycle craze and starting a new industry just in time, it turned out, for the coming of the automobile. Europeans had known about rubber ever since Christopher Columbus noticed it in the West Indies. In the late 1700s, a British scientist gave the substance its English name when he noticed it could rub out pencil marks. The Scot, Charles Mackintosh, contributed his name to the language in 1823 when he figured out a mass production method for doing something long practiced by the Indians of the Americas, applying rubber to cloth to make it waterproof. 16 years later, the American inventor, Charles Goodyear, accidentally spilled sulfur into some hot rubber on his stove. He discovered that the resulting mixture did not turn stiff when cold or smelly and gooey when hot. Major problems for those trying to make rubber boots or raincoats before then. But it was not until the early 1890s, half a decade after Dunlop fitted the pneumatic tire onto his son's tricycle wheel, that the worldwide rubber boom began. The industrial world rapidly developed an appetite, not just for rubber tyres, but for hoses, tubing, gaskets and the like, and for rubber insulation for the telegraph, telephone and electrical wiring now rapidly encompassing the globe. Suddenly, factories could not get enough of the magical commodity, and its price rose throughout the 1890s. Nowhere did the boom have a more drastic impact on people's lives than in the equatorial rainforest, where wild rubber vines snaked high into the trees that covered nearly half of King Leopold's Congo. For Leopold, the rubber boom was a godsend. He had gone dangerously into debt with his Congo investments, but he now saw that the return would be more lucrative than he had ever imagined. The world did not lose its desire for ivory, but by the late 1890s, wild rubber had far surpassed it as the main source of revenue from the Congo. His fortune assured, the king eagerly grilled functionaries returning from the Congo about rubber harvests. He devoured a constant stream of telegrams and reports from the territory, marking them up in the margins and passing them on to aides for action. His letters from this period are filled with numbers. Commodity prices from world markets, interest rates on loans, quantities of rifles to be shipped to the Congo, tons of rubber to be shipped to Europe, and the exact dimensions of the triumphal arch in Brussels he was planning to build with his newfound profits. Reading the king's correspondence is like reading the letters of the CEO of a corporation that has just developed a profitable new product and is racing to take advantage of it before competitors can get their assembly lines going. The competition Leopold worried about was from cultivated rubber, which comes not from a vine, but a tree. Rubber trees, however, require much care and some years before they grow large enough to be tapped. The king voraciously demanded ever greater quantities of wild rubber from the Congo because he knew that the price would drop once plantations of rubber trees in Latin America and Asia reached maturity. This did indeed happen, but by then the Congo had had a wild rubber boom nearly 2 decades long. During that time, the search knew no bounds. As with the men bringing in ivory, those supplying rubber to the Congo state and private companies were rewarded according to the amount they turned in. In 1903, one particularly productive agent received a commission 8 times his annual salary. But the big money flowed directly back to Antwerp and Brussels. In the capital, mostly to either side of the Rue Brederode, the small street that separated the back of the royal palace from several buildings holding offices of the Congo state and Congo business operations. Even though Leopold's privately controlled state got half of concession company profits, the king made vastly more money from the land the state exploited directly. But because the concession companies were not managed so secretively, we have better statistics from them. In 1897, for example, one of the companies, the Anglo-Belgian India Rubber and Exploration Company, or ABIR, spent 1.35 francs per kilo to harvest rubber in the Congo and ship it to the company's headquarters at Antwerp, where it was sold for prices that sometimes reached 10 francs per kilo, a profit of more than 700%. By 1898, the price of ABIR's stock was nearly 30 times what it had been 6 years earlier. Between 1890 and 1904, total Congo rubber earnings increased 96 times over. By the turn of the century, the État indépendant du Congo had become, far and away, the most profitable colony in Africa. The profits came swiftly because, transportation costs aside, harvesting wild rubber required no cultivation, no fertilizers, no capital investment in expensive equipment. It required only labor. How was this labor to be found? For the Congo's rulers, this posed a problem. They could not simply round up men, chain them together, and put them to work under the eye of an overseer with a chicot, as they did with porters. To gather wild rubber, people must disperse widely through the rainforests and often climb trees. Rubber is coagulated sap. The French word for it, caoutchouc, comes from a South American Indian word meaning the wood that weeps. The wood that wept in the Congo was a long, spongy vine of the Landolphia genus. Up to a foot thick at the base, a vine would twine upward around a tree to 100 feet or more off the ground, where it could reach sunlight. There, branching, it might wind its way hundreds of feet through the upper limbs of another half-dozen trees. To gather the rubber, you had to slash the vine with a knife and hang a bucket or earthenware pot to collect the slow drip of thick, milky sap. You could make a small incision to tap the vine, or, officially forbidden but widely practiced, cut through it entirely, which produced more rubber but killed the vine. Once the vines near a village were drained dry, workers had to go ever deeper into the forest until, before long, most harvesters were travelling at least 1 or 2 days to find fresh vines. As the lengths of vine within reach of the ground were tapped dry, workers climbed high into the trees to reach sap. We passed a man on the road who had broken his back by falling from a tree while tapping some vines, wrote one missionary. Furthermore, heavy tropical downpours during much of the year turned large areas of the rainforest where the rubber vines grew into swampland. No payments of trinkets or brass wire were enough to make people stay in the flooded forest for days at a time to do work that was so arduous and physically painful. A gatherer had to dry the syrup like rubber so that it would coagulate, and often the only way to do so was to spread the substance on his arms, thighs, and chest. The first few times it is not without pain that the man pulls it off the hairy parts of his body, Louis Chaltin, a Force Publique officer, confided to his journal in 1892. The native doesn't like making rubber. He must be compelled to do it. How was he to be compelled? A trickle of news and rumour gradually made its way to Europe. An example of what is done was told me up the Ubangi River, the British vice-consul reported in 1899. This officer's method was to arrive in canoes at a village, the inhabitants of which invariably bolted on their arrival. The soldiers were then landed and commenced looting, taking all the chickens, grain, etc. out of the houses. After this, they attacked the natives until able to seize their women. These women were kept as hostages until the chief of the district brought in the required number of kilograms of rubber. The rubber having been brought, the women were sold back to their owners for a couple of goats apiece, and so he continued from village to village until the requisite amount of rubber had been collected. Sometimes the hostages were women, sometimes children, sometimes elders or chiefs. Every state or company post in the rubber areas had a stockade for hostages. If you were a male villager, resisting the order to gather rubber could mean death for your wife. She might die anyway, for in the stockades food was scarce and conditions were harsh. The women taken during the last raid at Enguetra are causing me no end of trouble, wrote Force Publique officer Georges Bricus in his diary on November 22, 1895. All the soldiers want one. The sentries who are supposed to watch them unchain the prettiest ones and rape them. Leopold, of course, never proclaimed hostage-taking as official policy. If anyone made such charges, authorities in Brussels indignantly denied them. But out in the field, far from prying eyes, the pretense was dropped. Instructions on taking hostages were even given in the semi-official instruction book, the revealing Manuel du Voyageur et du Résident au Congo, a copy of which the administration gave to each agent at each state post. The manual's 5 volumes cover everything from keeping servants obedient to the proper firing of artillery salutes. Taking hostages was one more routine piece of work. In Africa, taking prisoners is an easy thing to do, for if the natives hide, they will not go far from their village and must come to look for food in the gardens which surround it. In watching these carefully, you will be certain of capturing people after a brief delay. When you feel you have enough captives, you should choose among them an old person, preferably an old woman. Make her a present and send her to the chief to begin negotiations. The chief, wanting to see his people set free, will usually decide to send representatives. Seldom does history offer us a chance to see such detailed instructions for those carrying out a regime of terror. The tips on hostage-taking are in the volume of the manual called Practical Questions, which was compiled by an editorial committee of about 30 people. One member, he worked on the book during a 2-year period following his stint as the head-collecting station chief at Stanley Falls, was Leon Rom. Hostage-taking set the Congo apart from most other forced labour regimes, but in other ways it resembled them. As would be true decades later of the Soviet Gulag, another slave labour system for harvesting raw materials, the Congo operated by quotas. In Siberia, the quotas concerned cubic metres of timber cut or tons of gold ore mined by prisoners each day. In the Congo, the quota was for kilos of rubber. In the ABIR concession company's rich territory, just below the Congo River's great half-circle bend, for example, the normal quota assigned to each village was 3 to 4 kilos of dried rubber per adult male per fortnight, which essentially meant full-time labour for those men. Elsewhere, quotas were higher and might be raised as time went on. An official in the Mongala River Basin in the far north, controlled by another concession company, the Société Inversoise du Commerce au Congo, estimated that to fill their quota, rubber gatherers had to spend 24 days a month in the forest, where they built crude cages to sleep in for protection, not always successful against leopards. To get at parts of the vine high off the ground, men frantic to get every possible drop of rubber would sometimes tear down the whole vine, slice it into sections and squeeze the rubber out. Although the Congo state issued strict orders against killing the vines this way, it also applied the chicotte to men who didn't bring in enough rubber. The chicotte prevailed. One witness saw Africans who had to dig up roots in order to find enough rubber to meet their quotas. The entire system was militarized. Force publique garrisons were scattered everywhere, often supplying their firepower to the companies under contract. In addition, each company had its own militia force, euphemistically called sentries. In military matters, as in almost everything else, the companies operated as an extension of the Congo state. And when hostages had to be taken or a rebellious village subdued, company sentries and force publique soldiers often took to the field together. Wherever rubber vines grew, the population was tightly controlled. Usually, you had to get a permit from the state or company agent in order to visit a friend or relative in another village. In some areas, you were required to wear a numbered metal disc attached to a cord around your neck, so that company agents could keep track of whether you had met your quota. Huge numbers of Africans were conscripted into this labor army. In 1906, the books of ABIR alone, responsible for only a small fraction of the Congo state's rubber production, listed 47,000 rubber gatherers. All along the rivers, columns of exhausted men carrying baskets of lumpy grey rubber on their heads sometimes walked 20 miles or more to assemble near the houses of European agents, who sat on their verandas and weighed the loads of rubber. At one collection point, a missionary counted 400 men with baskets. After the sap was turned in, it was formed into rough slabs, each the size of a small suitcase, and left to dry in the sun. Then it was shipped downriver on a barge or scow towed by a steamboat, the first stage of the long journey to Europe. The state and the companies generally paid villagers for their rubber with a piece of cloth, beads, a few spoonfuls of salt, or a knife. These cost next to nothing, and the knives were essential tools for gathering more rubber. On at least one occasion, a chief who forced his people to gather rubber was paid in human beings. A legal dispute between two white officials near Stanley Falls put the following exchange on record in 1901. The witness being questioned was Liamba, chief of a village named Malinda. Question: Did Monsieur Hotio, a company official, ever give you living women or children? Answer: Yes, he gave me 6 women and 2 men. Question: What for? Answer: In payment for rubber, which I brought into the station, telling me I could eat them, or kill them, or use them as slaves, as I liked. The rainforest bordering the Kasai River was rich in rubber, and William Shepherd and the other American Presbyterians there found themselves in the midst of a cataclysm. The Kasai was also the scene of some of the strongest resistance to Leopold's rule. Armed men of a chief allied with the regime rampaged through the region where Shepherd worked, plundering and burning more than a dozen villages. Floods of desperate refugees sought help at Shepherd's mission station. In 1899, the reluctant Shepherd was ordered by his superiors to travel into the bush, at some risk to himself, to investigate the source of the fighting. There he found blood-stained ground, destroyed villages, and many bodies. The air was thick with the stench of rotting flesh. On the day he reached the marauders' camp, his eye was caught by a large number of objects being smoked. The chief conducted us to a framework of sticks under which was burning a slow fire. And there they were, the right hands. I counted them, 81 in all. The chief told Shepherd, "See, here is our evidence. I always have to cut off the right hands of those we kill in order to show the state how many we have killed." He proudly showed Shepherd some of the bodies the hands had come from. The smoking preserved the hands in the hot, moist climate, for it might be days or weeks before the chief could display them to the proper official and receive credit for his kills. Shepherd had stumbled on one of the most grisly aspects of Leopold's rubber system. Like the hostage-taking, the severing of hands was deliberate policy, as even high officials would later admit. During my time in the Congo, I was the first commissioner of the Equator District, recalled Charles Lemaire after his retirement. As soon as it was a question of rubber, I wrote to the government, "To gather rubber in the district, one must cut off hands, noses, and ears." If a village refused to submit to the rubber regime, state or company troops or their allies sometimes shot everyone in sight, so that nearby villages would get the message. But on such occasions, some European officers were mistrustful. For each cartridge issued to their soldiers, they demanded proof that the bullet had been used to kill someone, not wasted in hunting, or, worse yet, saved for possible use in a mutiny. The standard proof was the right hand from a corpse, or occasionally not from a corpse. Sometimes, said one officer to a missionary, soldiers shot a cartridge at an animal in hunting. They then cut off a hand from a living man. In some military units there was even a keeper of the hands. His job was the smoking. Shepherd was not the first foreign witness to see severed hands in the Congo, nor would he be the last. But the articles he wrote for missionary magazines about his grisly find were reprinted and quoted widely, both in Europe and the United States. And it is partly due to him that people overseas began to associate the Congo with severed hands. A half-dozen years after Shepherd's stark discovery, while attacking the expensive public works Leopold was building with his Congo profits, the socialist leader Emile van der Velde would speak in the Belgian parliament of monumental arches which one will someday call the arches of the severed hands. William Shepherd's outspokenness would eventually bring down the wrath of the authorities, and one day van der Velde, an attorney, would find himself defending Shepherd in a Congo courtroom. But that is getting ahead of our story. As the rubber terror spread throughout the rainforest, it branded people with memories that remained raw for the rest of their lives. A Catholic priest who recorded oral histories half a century later quotes a man, Tswambe, speaking of a particularly hated state official named Leon Fieves, who terrorized a district along the river 300 miles north of Stanley Pool. All the blacks saw this man as the devil of the equator. From all the bodies killed in the field, you had to cut off the hands. He wanted to see the number of hands cut off by each soldier, who had to bring them in baskets. A village which refused to provide rubber would be completely swept clean. As a young man, I saw Fieves's soldier Molili, then guarding the village of Boyeka, take a big net, put 10 arrested natives in it, attach big stones to the net, and make it tumble into the river. Rubber caused these torments. That's why we no longer want to hear its name spoken. Soldiers made young men kill or rape their own mothers and sisters. A force publique officer who passed through Fieves's post in 1894 quotes Fieves himself describing what he did when the surrounding villages failed to supply his troops with the fish and manioc he had demanded. "I made war against them. One example was enough. 100 heads cut off, and there have been plenty of supplies at the station ever since. My goal is ultimately humanitarian. I killed 100 people, but that allowed 500 others to live." With humanitarian ground rules that included cutting off hands and heads, sadists like Fieves had a field day. The station chief at Mbima used his revolver to shoot holes in Africans' earlobes. Raoul de Premorel, an agent working along the Kasai River, enjoyed giving large doses of castor oil to people he considered malingerers. When villagers, in a desperate attempt to meet the weight quota, turned in rubber mixed with dirt or pebbles to the agent Alberic de Thiege, he made them eat it. When two porters failed to use a designated latrine, a district commissioner, Jean Verdussen, ordered them paraded in front of troops, their faces rubbed with excrement. As news of the white man's soldiers and their baskets of severed hands spread through the Congo, a myth gained credence with Africans that was a curious reversal of the white obsession with black cannibalism. The cans of corned beef seen in white men's houses, it was said, did not contain meat from the animals shown on the label. They contained chopped-up hands. Chapter 11. A Secret Society of Murderers. Once when Leopold and Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany were watching a parade in Berlin, Leopold, grumbling about the erosion of royal authority, remarked to the Kaiser, "There is really nothing left for us kings except money." Rubber would soon bring Leopold money beyond imagining. but the Congo alone was never enough to satisfy him. Fantasizing an empire that would encompass the two legendary rivers of Africa, the Congo and the Nile, he imagined linking the rivers by a great railway, and in the early 1890s dispatched expeditions northeast from the Congo toward the Nile Valley. One of these claimed the ancient copper mines of Bahr el Ghazal, taking care to claim the mines for Leopold personally while committing the Congo state to provide military protection. The French finally blocked the king from further moves toward the Nile, but he was already dreaming of new colonies elsewhere. "I would like to make out of our little Belgium, with its 6 million people, the capital of an immense empire," he said. "The Netherlands, Spain, Portugal are in a state of decadence, and their colonies will one day or another come onto the market." He asked Prime Minister William Gladstone of England about the possibility of leasing Uganda. Leopold was quick to embellish his imperial schemes with any humanitarian sentiment in the air. In 1896, he proposed to another surprised British Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury, that a Sudanese army under Congo state officers be used for the purpose of invading and occupying Armenia, and so putting a stop to the massacres of Armenians by the Turks, which were moving Europe so deeply. Queen Victoria thought her cousin Leopold was becoming delusional. When there was a crisis in Crete, he suggested that Congolese troops help restore order. After the United States won the Spanish-American War, he proposed that a corporation lease some of Spain's remaining territories, such as the Canary Islands in the Atlantic or the Carolines in the South Pacific. The corporation, he suggested, could be registered in a neutral state, such as, for example, the État indépendant du Congo. None of these dreams distracted Leopold from managing his main source of income. He kept the Congo's growing profitability as secret as possible, however, lest it stir up demands that he pay back the Belgian government's big loan. For as long as Leopold could get away with it, the Congo state did not publish a budget. When at last it did so, it presented revenue figures that grossly understated the state's real profits. One advantage of controlling your own country is that you can issue bonds. This eventually was to become a source of revenue for Leopold almost equal to that of rubber. All told, the king issued bonds worth more than 100 million francs, or roughly half a billion of today's dollars. Some bonds he sold, some he gave to favourites, some he kept for his personal portfolio, some he used in lieu of cash to pay for public works projects in Belgium. Since the bonds were for terms as long as 99 years, Leopold knew that paying back the principal would be somebody else's problem. Supposedly the bond money was for development in the Congo, but little of it was ever spent there. Leopold much preferred to spend it and his Congo rubber profits in Europe. For such a shrewd and ambitious man, he was notably unimaginative in his tastes, and used his vast new fortune in ways that would earn him a place less in the history books than in the guidebooks. A string of monuments, new palace wings, museums and pavilions began going up all over Belgium. At his favourite seaside resort, Ostend, Leopold poured millions of francs into a promenade, several parks, and an elaborately turreted gallery, decorated with 85,000 geraniums for its opening, for the racetrack he frequented. Rubber earnings also financed a golf course at nearby Klemskerk, a royal chalet at Raverside, and endless renovations and the enlargement of the Chateau of Laeken. Many of these riches Leopold officially gave to his country with much fanfare as a royal gift, although he continued to live in the castles and palaces in the same manner as he always had. His real purposes in bestowing the royal gift were to have the nation pay for the upkeep of these properties, and to keep them out of the hands of his three daughters, to whom Belgian law required that he leave his personal possessions. In 1895, Leopold turned 60. And as he grew older, he became a hypochondriac. Any aide who coughed risked banishment for several days. Always fearful of getting a cold, he wore a waterproof bag around his beard when he went outside in wet weather or swam in the sea. He demanded that the palace tablecloths be boiled daily to kill germs. When not travelling, he lived mostly at Laeken. He rose early, had a cold shower, trimmed his great beard, received a massage, read the early morning mail, and ate a huge breakfast. A half dozen poached eggs, a stack of toast, and an entire jar of marmalade. Then he spent much of the day walking around his beloved gardens and greenhouses, often reading mail and dictating answers while on the move. His secretaries had to learn to write while walking. Lunch lasted precisely half an hour. The king read newspapers and letters while eating, and sometimes scribbled instructions in the margins of letters, in nearly illegible handwriting, that his staff spent anxious hours each day deciphering. Other family members at the table were expected to remain silent. In the afternoon, he was driven to the royal palace in downtown Brussels to meet officials and visitors, then back to Laeken for the evening meal. The high point of his day was the arrival of the Times of London. Each afternoon, a carefully wrapped copy of that morning's paper was tossed from the Ostend-Basel Express as the train passed the private railway station bearing the royal coat of arms at Laeken. A footman ironed the paper, germs again, and the king read it in bed at night. When the Times later joined his chorus of critics, Leopold angrily announced that he was stopping his subscription. But he secretly sent his valet to the Brussels railway station each day to buy him a copy. Perhaps Leopold liked the Times because it was a newspaper written not for a small country, but for a powerful one. In any case, his lust for colonies still extended to all corners of the world. In 1897, he started to invest Congo state profits in a railway in China, eventually making big money on the deal. He saw that country as he had seen the magnificent African cake, a feast to be consumed, and he was as ready as ever to invite himself to the table. Of the route he hoped to get for his railway line, he said, "This is the spine of China. If they give it to me, I'll also take some cutlets." He tried to arrange an exchange, Chinese laborers for the Congo, Congolese soldiers for China, that would give him a military foot in the door, like the other Western powers now maneuvering in the Far East. He bought several small parcels of land in China in the name of the État indépendant du Congo. When Leopold sent a Congo state delegation, all Belgians, of course, for negotiations, the Chinese viceroy, Li Hongchang, feigned surprise. "Am I right in thinking that Africans are black?" Back in the Congo, the rubber boom gave added urgency to the territory's major construction job, the narrow-gauge railway from Matadi to Stanley Pool, around the Big Rapids. This project required up to 60,000 workers at one time. Although the line was only 241 miles long and little more than half the width of American standard-gauge tracks, climate, disease, and terrain made it one of the more daunting railway construction projects in history. It took 3 years to build just the first 14 miles. An early surveyor of this forbidding stretch of land described it as a piling up of enormous stones which, in certain places, seemed to have been thrown on top of each other by the hands of giants. The whole route required 99 metal bridges, totaling more than 12 miles in length. Construction workers were brought in from British and French territories in West Africa, from Hong Kong and Macau, and from the British West Indies. Leopold remained fascinated with the idea of using Chinese workers in the Congo. "What would it cost," he wrote to an aide, "to establish 5 big Chinese villages in the Congo? One in the north, another in the northeast, one in the east, another in the south, and one between Matadi and Leopoldville. 2,000 Chinese to mark our frontiers. What would it cost?" The idea of 5 villages vanished, but Leopold's dream did cost the lives of many of the 540 Chinese brought to work on the railway in 1892. 300 of them died on the job or fled into the bush. Most of the latter were never seen again, although several were later found more than 500 miles in the interior. They had walked toward the rising sun, trying to get to Africa's east coast and then home. Several hundred laborers from the Caribbean island of Barbados had evidently been told they were being recruited for somewhere else, when their ship tied up at Boma in September 1892, and they realized they were in the Congo, they rebelled in fury. Soldiers fired at them, killing 2 and wounding many more. The rest were sent on to the railhead at Matadi the same day and put to work. The railway was a modest engineering success and a major human disaster. Men succumbed to accidents, dysentery, smallpox, beriberi, and malaria, all exacerbated by bad food and relentless floggings by the 200-man railway militia force. Engines ran off tracks, freight cars full of dynamite exploded, blowing to bits workers black and white. Sometimes there were no shelters for the people to sleep in, and recalcitrant laborers were led to work in chains. The European construction foremen and engineers could cancel their contracts and go home, and a steady flow did so. The black and Asian workers could not. When bugles sounded in the morning, crowds of angry labourers laid at the feet of European supervisors the bodies of their comrades who had died during the night. In a metaphor that is echoed elsewhere in Africa, local legend along the railway line has it that each tie cost one African life and each telegraph pole one European life. Even in the rosy official figures, the railway death toll was 132 whites and 1,800 non-whites. Some estimates, however, place the non-white toll close to 1,800 a year in the first 2 years, which were the worst. Cemeteries dotted the rail line. Again and again, workers tried to escape. 300 men from Sierra Leone, brandishing hammers, shovels and pickaxes, stormed the port of Matadi and tried to commandeer a ship at the dock to take them home. Club-wielding guards, themselves recruited from Zanzibar, forced them back. Other workers went on strike or fled to nearby Portuguese territory. In 1898, 8 years after construction started, the first short, stumpy steam engine, bedecked with flags, pulled two railway cars all the way up the narrow-gauge track from Matadi to Stanley Pool. A large tent decorated with flowers awaited its arrival. State officials, military men, officers of the railway, and a bishop all banqueted and drank to Leopold's health in champagne. The assembled VIPs ceremonially bolted the last rail, a cannon fired a 21-gun salute, and all the steamboats in Stanley Pool blew their whistles. Officials erected a monument on the old caravan route that the rail line had replaced. Three life-size metal figures of porters, one carrying a large box on his head, two collapsed in exhaustion beside him. The inscription read, "The railway freed them from porterage." It said nothing about who made them become porters in the first place. Although it included hairpin turns and steep grades that stretched a one-way trip to 2 days, the railway added enormously to the state's power and wealth. The more than 11 million pounds of rubber a year the Congo was producing by the turn of the century could now reach the sea from the steamboat docks of Stanley Pool without being carried for 3 weeks on men's heads. Rail cars going the other direction moved steamboats around the rapids in far larger pieces than porters could carry. Leopoldville quickly became the busiest river port in Central Africa, home to steamers of up to 500 tons. One side-wheeler on the river, the 60-ton Ville de Paris, had begun life as an excursion boat on the Seine. Except for those employed by the state or on projects like the railway, Leopold was wary of foreigners in the Congo. He was, however, saddled with one group of them, several hundred foreign Protestant missionaries, like William Shepherd and his colleagues. Almost all had come from England, the United States, or Sweden, countries where Leopold hoped to curry favour. The missionaries had come to the Congo eager to evangelise, to fight polygamy, and to impart to Africans a Victorian sense of sin. A high state official visiting the Congo river town of Upoto recorded in astonishment in his diary that a British missionary wanted him to issue a decree making the natives wear clothes. Before long, however, the rubber terror meant that missionaries had trouble finding bodies to clothe or souls to save. Frightened villagers would disappear into the jungle for weeks when they saw the smoke of an approaching steamboat on the horizon. One British missionary was asked repeatedly by Africans, "Has the saviour you tell us of any power to save us from the rubber trouble?" Unexpectedly, certainly without intending to take on such a role, the missionaries found themselves acting as observers on a battlefield, and Shepherd was by no means the only one who bore witness. In 1894, a Swedish missionary recorded a despairing Congolese song. "We are tired of living under this tyranny. We cannot endure that our women and children are taken away and dealt with by the white savages. We shall make war. We know that we shall die, but we want to die. We want to die." Due to the missionaries, from the mid-1890s on, Leopold had to deal with scattered protests, like Shepherd's articles, about severed hands and slaughtered Africans. But the critics at first captured little attention, for they were not as skilled at public relations as the king, who deployed his formidable charm to neutralize them. As a start, he encouraged mission society officials to talk with him directly, personally urging one French clergyman to do this, instead of having recourse to the press, which is always unpleasant, toujours désagréable. Then he artfully used both promise and threat. While cultivating their leaders, he made sure to remind the mission societies of the Congo State's ability to impose taxes or deny permission to build new missions. The Southern Presbyterian Mission where Shepherd worked had endless trouble getting new land it wanted to build on. A Swedish Baptist missionary, E.V. Sjöblom, was perhaps Leopold's most forceful critic in the late 1890s, speaking to all who would listen and publishing a detailed attack on the Congo's rubber terror in the Swedish press in 1896, an attack that was picked up by newspapers in other countries. At a public meeting in London the following year, Sjöblom told how African Force Publique soldiers were rewarded for the number of hands they collected. An agent told me that he had himself seen a state officer at one of the outposts pay a certain number of brass rods, local currency, to the soldiers for a number of hands they had brought. One of the soldiers told me, "The commissioner has promised us if we have plenty of hands, he will shorten our service. I have brought in plenty of hands already, and I expect my time of service will soon be finished." State officials threatened Sjöblom in the Congo itself and quickly counterattacked in the Belgian and British press. Another knowledgeable opponent of Leopold's was H.R. Fox Bourne, Secretary of the Aborigines Protection Society, a group that had grown considerably wiser since it had elected Leopold its honorary president a decade earlier. The king himself reportedly paid a visit to the office of the Times in London to try to persuade the newspaper not to run Fox Bourne's articles. Publicly, however, Leopold took the high road, pronouncing himself deeply shocked at reports of misdeeds in his domain. Most accusations he was able to survive with little damage, for they concerned atrocities committed against Africans. But in 1895 he faced his first real trouble in Europe when a particularly brutal Congo state officer, as one shocked British journalist put it, dared to kill an Englishman. The victim was actually Irish. Charles Stokes, a colourful, flamboyant trader who had, as the British like to say, gone native, marrying an African woman. Stokes's ivory trading competed with the lucrative monopoly Leopold was trying to establish in the eastern Congo. He was also accused of selling arms to the Afro-Arabs. A Force Publique expedition went looking for Stokes near the state's eastern border, found him and hanged him on the spot. The London press thundered its outrage. There was also a wave of protest in Germany, for Stokes's home base was in German East Africa, and the Congo state was supposedly open to German traders. In a vain attempt to dampen the outcry, the Congo government admitted its mistake and made large indemnity payments to the British and German governments. But this was not the end of the matter. One German paper declared that if the Congo had so cavalierly executed a white man, think what it must do to the natives. The European press began paying more attention to news of Congo atrocities. Leopold had to act. In 1896, he appointed the Commission for the Protection of the Natives. 6 prominent Congo missionaries, 3 of them Belgian Catholics, 3 foreign Protestants. The commission was greeted as a good thing everywhere in Europe, especially in England, where the king was most worried about criticism. "It is wholly to King Leopold's credit that he should have squarely faced the facts of the situation," said the Manchester Guardian. Few people noticed that none of the commission members was based in any of the prime rubber areas where the atrocity reports were coming from, that the commissioners were scattered over more than 1,000 miles, that the king had provided no money for them to travel to meetings, that one of the British members had previously advised his fellow missionaries against publishing any atrocity stories, that another had surveyed the Congo-Angola frontier for Leopold, and that the commission had no power whatever except to inform the Congo state authorities about abuses. The commission met only twice, and each time, because of distance and expense, only 3 of the 6 members managed to attend. But for Leopold, the move was a public relations coup, and he cemented his triumph with visits to England, Germany, and Sweden in the summer of 1897. For the next few years, Britons were distracted by the Boer War, and attacks on Leopold almost completely disappeared from the European press. The king's critics kept up sporadic fire, but no one seemed to heed them. They despaired of attracting much attention again. Had there been approval ratings in Europe at the time, the closing years of the century would have found Leopold at his peak of favour, both abroad and at home. In Belgium, colonial chauvinism now began to bubble up in verse. Sur les plages où les entraîne la voix d'un sage souverain, nos soldats vont l'âme sereine affronte un climat d'arène. De l'Africain briser la chaîne et dompte l'Arabe inhumaine. On the beaches where a wise sovereign's voice draws them, our soldiers, hearts serene, brave the brazen climate, to break the African's chain and subdue the cruel Arab. However, the sovereign's voice pushed rather than drew his soldiers to the beachheads, for although the Congo was the dominating passion of his life, Leopold never went there. Why should he have done so? The Congo, in Leopold's mind, was not the one of starving porters, raped hostages, emaciated rubber slaves, and severed hands. It was the empire of his dreams, with gigantic trees, exotic animals, and inhabitants grateful for his wise rule. Instead of going there, Leopold brought the Congo, that Congo, the theatrical production of his imagination, to himself. Red mahogany from it panelled the bedroom of his private railway car. Animals from it appeared in Belgian zoos. And to the array of huge greenhouses at Laeken, the king added a Congo greenhouse, still full of palm trees today, topped with four glass cupolas and an octagonal dome bearing the star emblem of his private state. From that serene, picturesque Congo stage setting of his fantasy, Leopold brought to himself even its people. In 1897, when a World's Fair took place in Brussels, the most talked-about exhibit was on the outskirts of the city, at Tervuren. More than 1 million visitors came to see this celebration of the Congo. Items on display ranged from that great instrument of civilization so praised by Stanley, who twice visited the fair, the Maxim gun, to a large set of linen tapestries portraying barbarism and civilization, fetishism and Christianity, polygamy and family life, slavery and freedom. The most extraordinary tableau, however, was a living one. 267 black men, women, and children imported from the Congo. These were not the only indigenous people placed on exhibit at World's Fairs and elsewhere around the turn of the century. Perhaps the most appalling case was that of Otabenga, a pygmy from the Congo who was displayed in the monkey house of New York's Bronx Zoo in September 1906. An orangutan shared his space. Visitors ogled his teeth, filed, newspaper articles hinted, for devouring human flesh. To further this impression, zookeepers left a few bones scattered on the floor around him. A poem published in the New York Times declared that Otabenga had been brought from his native land of darkness to the country of the free, in the interest of science and of broad humanity. The promoter who staged this exhibit was a former Presbyterian missionary who abandoned his preaching for several business ventures. A delegation of black ministers finally rescued Otabenga from the zoo. He remained in the United States and committed suicide 10 years later. With great fanfare, they were brought by train to Brussels' Gare du Nord, and then marched across the center of the city to take the tram for Tervuren. There, in a park, they were installed in 3 specially constructed villages, a river village, a forest village, and a civilized village. A pair of pygmies rounded out the show. The uncivilized Africans of the first 2 villages used tools, drums, and cooking pots brought from home. They danced and paddled their dugout canoes around a pond. During the day they were on exhibit in authentic bamboo African huts with overhanging thatched roofs. European men hoping to see the fabled bare breasts of Africa went away disappointed, however, for the women were made to wear cotton dressing gowns while at the fair. Clothing, a local magazine observed, was, after all, the first sign of civilization. Leopold himself came to see the Congolese, his dream made flesh, and was introduced to one of their chiefs. Told that some of the Africans were suffering from indigestion because of snacks and candy given them by the public, he ordered up the equivalent of a "Don't feed the animals" sign. The placard said, "The blacks are fed by the organizing committee." They were fed, and slept, in the royal stables. The local press titillated its readers by speculating about whether the uncivilized Africans were dangerous. A reporter approached a circle of them. At the center, sitting on a log, was the chief, motionless and sacrosanct. The voice of a singer was first heard alone. Then a chorus picked up a refrain, accompanied by hand claps and the banging of sticks on metal objects, and by a swaying motion of these crouching bodies. And what were the soloist and chorus singing about? The magnificent deeds of Force Publique Captain Hubert Lothaire, the great warrior. All was well. The Africans of the civilized village included 90 Force Publique soldiers, some of whom made up a military band. The soldiers marched, the band played, and near the end of their stay were guests at a banquet. A black sergeant rose and proposed a toast to King Leopold II. When the Africans sailed for home, a newspaper rhapsodized, "The soul of Belgium follows them, and, like the shield of Jupiter, protects them. May we always thus show the world an example of humanity." The ship that took the Congolese back to their homeland probably returned to Belgium with a cargo of rubber, for the riches of the Congo were now flowing to Europe on a regular schedule. Every few weeks, a fine new steamer, equipped with electric lights and refrigerators, arrived at Antwerp filled with rubber, ivory, and other products. The vessels belonged to a subsidiary of Elder Dempster, a Liverpool-based shipping line whose steamers had long plied the west coast of Africa. The firm had the contract for carrying all kinds